have 11.
So we have an exam a week from Friday, a week from today, and I'll spend some time today reviewing for the exam. I wanted to wrap up with a couple more examples about transfer functions and specifically talk about feedback. And then we'll spend some time reviewing. And the topic we'll talk about today, feedback, is actually, as you can imagine, used extensively in electric systems, but it's also used actually in mechanical systems. And if I remember right, these are some kind of feedback controlled motors or something. There's a link to the page that contains those. But feedback is used extensively throughout many, many different kinds of systems to try to stabilize systems, to try to control systems, to try to make them behave in a stable manner or behave the way you want them to behave. And we'll begin learning a little bit about that today. And then we'll spend more time on that when we get to the control system section of the course. So let's take another look at block diagrams. Blocks can be thought of as subsystems that make up a system described by a signal flow graph. We can reduce such graphs to a transfer function. And that's, I think, a really critical part of engineering today. Whenever you look at if you look at, for example, an end-to-end design of a microprocessor, you know, that has several million gates associated with it. If you think about that design as it exists in a tool like SPICE or whatever, it's really a hierarchy of systems. There's some high-level blocks, and then those blocks in turn are expanded in lower-level blocks. And you know, you wind yourself all the way down, and somewhere at the bottom, hopefully, is a transistor or a circuit or something. But most of you will be hard pressed to ever see that. You'll spend most of your time up at the block level. We have a lot of tools today in engineering to allow you to design and manipulate systems at the block level without ever really seeing the details. But invariably, when you're pushing the limits of the technology or when something goes wrong, then you have to begin to understand how your models differ from what's behaving in the real world. So, for example, with circuits, your models will work fine when you're within the normal operating parameters of the circuits, but when you want to push the speed of the circuit much higher than what it's been designed for, then your models, you'll start to face more and more the inaccuracies of your models and things like that. So it's important to, whenever you're dealing with these high-level descriptions, to have some appreciation for the accuracy of the models that you're dealing with. But quite a lot of design today is done at the block diagram level. So let's look at two fundamental configurations to the block in block diagrams. One is what's called a parallel connection, and one is what's called a series connection. So with a parallel connection, we have an input, we have an output, and we'd like to get the overall transfer function of this system. And this looks familiar because you're used to doing this with circuits, but in this class we're generalizing this concept to things beyond circuits. So we can write that the output y of s is equal to y1 plus y2. So that gives us this equation. We can write that y1 of s is x of s times h1 of s. And y2 of s is x of s times h2 of s. So y of s, then, combining these equations, can be written as h1 times x of s plus h2 times x of s. And then we can solve for y of s over x of s is just h1 plus h2. So we can decompose this parallel connection to simply the sum of the two transfer functions. And we can do a similar thing for a series connection. Here we have x of s, h1 of s, y1 of s, h2 of s, y2 of s. We can write that y1 of s is equal to h1 times x of s. We can write that y2 of s is equal to y1 of s times h2 of s. We can then substitute for y1 h1 times x of s. And we can write then that y of s is equal to h1 times h2 times x of s. So y of s over x of s, which is what we call the transfer function, is just h1 times h2. So this is what's called a series or a cascade connection of the two systems. Now with these two properties, you can actually decompose a lot of systems. You can take very complicated flow graphs and decompose them into much simpler structures where you simply replace this with the overall system transfer function. But there's one type of connection that we haven't talked about yet, which is a feedback connection, which we'll talk about shortly. And then that will sort of complete our array of tools that we need so that you can decompose things like circuits and other systems into single transfer functions. But before I do that, I want to raise one issue about this, just to make you think a little bit about this. In this course, we've been dealing thus far with linear time-invariant systems. And this all looks very nice and clean in the world of abstract mathematics. However, suppose you were to try to do this using real-world circuits, using, for example, two simple transistor amplifiers. What kind of, will this actually work? And before you answer that, think about a simple case. Think about, suppose this represents, something like a voltage generator in a high voltage lab. Million volts, 100,000 amps, right? I don't know whatever they can generate there. And then suppose this represents your op amp. What's a common op amp number? Like 74 something or other? 741. Okay? And suppose you connect the two together and you come to me and say, here, Dr. Piccone, the transfer function is H1 times H2. Well, by the time you've actually run to me to bring me the piece of paper, what's happening to this guy?
This disappears.
This basically toast, right?
It's going to be obsolete.
So what happened?
It exceeded the parameters.
It exceeded the parameters. So when you connected these two systems together, what happened?
We let smoke out.
The magic smoke.
That's not a method.
What happened from a transfer function point of view? So this analysis is perfectly valid, except there's a caveat here that you need to always remember when you're working with real systems. When we just look at the high voltage lab by itself, yes, its generator behaved this way. When we just looked at the op amp by itself, it behaved this way. What happens when we actually connect them together? What happens to the property of these boxes?
Dependent on one
another. Why? From an electrical point of view, what's happening?
They're in series.
Exceeding the limits.
You're exceeding the limits. And that's a specific example of sort of a general problem that you always worry about with electric circuits, and it's one of the reasons why you like designing things with op amps. I don't know if you were like me, but when I got to the op amps lab, I thought this was great because it just kind of plugged them together. We used to have these old analog computers, we just patched things together, and everything was fine, right? But when you were trying to do that with transistor circuits, simple transistor circuits, it didn't work that way. Why?
They're starting to put
impedances, right? And when you connect these together, what happens to the properties of this when you connect this? What do we call that loading, right?
Yep.
Because there's finite impedances between them, this box actually loads this box and changes its behavior. When we connect this thing to the high voltage generator, the behavior of this device changes pretty quickly, right? It fries. So this all works well and good in mathematical worlds of simulations, but with electric circuits, you have to be very careful that when you connect these together, there aren't interactions between these two blocks. Now, why is designing circuits with op amps so nice with regards to this?
They have infinite impedance.
So they're essentially buffer. They're buffers, and in fact, you'll learn if you haven't already about things like buffer amplifiers, which are often used sometimes when you want to isolate circuits. If you're building a piece of consumer electronics equipment and you provide these little jacks on the back of these boxes, what do you as a circuit designer have to worry about?
Buffer and what they're going to load it to.
If they're going to short, if they're going to load, you know, if they're going to connect it to the line voltage, all, you know, and that's why with in the real, you know, with real circuits like that, you build in protection for those kinds of things. So this all works great, but just remember that in the act of connecting these two boxes, you may actually load one of the boxes and change its behavior in the real world. And we actually used to demonstrate that with a little problem with circuits, but I think you can get the point there. So let's talk next about feedback. Feedback plays a major role in signals and systems. For example, it's one way to stabilize an unstable system. We talked a couple classes ago about one of the ways that they stabilize these tall skyscrapers now is actually have active loads at the top of these skyscrapers that they adjust in real time to kind of keep the building from not vibrating too much. And in automotive systems, feedback is used extensively as well. A good example of that is cruise control, for example. You know, the way cruise controls, as your car hits an incline, what happens to when you're driving under cruise control and your car hits an incline, what happens? Well, the car starts to slow in speed. So what does your cruise control do? It increases. But what kind of intelligence is needed to make sure that this actually works properly? So it increases, and then the car eventually gets up to speed, and then you go to maybe come down the downside of that hill, and now you're going faster and has to do the same. But what differentiates that incline from a very small little bump on the road? So one of the tricks with cruise control is that you don't instantaneously adjust the changes in speed, so you'd be constantly adjusting the motor speed, engine speed, and you'd lose all the advantages of good gas mileage. So cruise controls actually use a feedback with a low-pass filtering so that they smooth over these instantaneous changes in speed. On the other hand, if someone is braking, you want to, you know, there's a lot of operating conditions you have to worry about. So feedback is a good example of that. You may sometimes feel your car, as it's trying to adjust its speed, you can sort of feel the car kind of have a mind of its own. That's basically a control system trying to achieve the final result of getting back to the speed you set the car to, but you don't just do that, you know, in a quick, there's an art to doing that so that the car performs properly. And you may have encountered situations where you get in extreme cases of inclines or something where the car can't actually track speed properly. And state-of-the-art in cruise control now is actually trying to do look-aheads with lasers and all these kinds of things to try to be very intelligent about the way it adjusts to the conditions. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but...
So that's pretty serious.
Yeah, well, it's, I think that's actually a feature on some of the new high-end cars.
It's implemented. It's mainly used for slowing down in traffic. Like, you come up behind somebody that's going 2 miles an hour slower than you, slows you down to their speed, and then they move the speed back up.
Yeah.
$5 worth of car.
Right. And $1,450 worth of good engineering, right?
Yeah.
making sure that it doesn't actually kill somebody. It's actually probably $1,400 in insurance, $5 in parts, and maybe $20 in engineering.
That's more like it.
Okay, so we have X of S. We have a summer here. We have a filtered version of X of S here, of X1 of S here, and then we feedback the output into the input. So let's go ahead and analyze the property of this system. So we can write that Y1 of S is equal to H1 of S times X1 of S. We don't know X1 yet, but we'll hopefully be able to figure out X1 by writing something about this node. But Y1 is equal to X1 times H1. X1 is equal to X of S minus Y2, but Y2 is equal to H2 times Y, so we can write that X1 of S is equal to X of S minus H2 times Y2. So we can then we can write that Y of S, which is Y1 here, is equal to H1, and then for X1 of S, we can substitute X of S minus H2 times Y, and then we can put everything with Y on the left-hand side and everything with X on the right-hand side, and we can then write that Y of S is equal to H1 of S over 1 plus H1 H2 times X of S. So the overall transfer function, Y of S over X of S, is H1 over 1 plus H1 H2. So, the one thing you might think about is how does the addition of feedback influence the stability of the system? And what we mean by that is, suppose you have a system here that's just H1. It's going to have a certain stability to it. Maybe stable, maybe unstable. The overall transfer function of this system is now a combination of H1 and H2. So, as we'll see later in the course, we can actually design H2 so that we can control and stabilize H1. And that's essentially what is the whole area of feedback controls is about if you go into the feedback course as a senior elective. And we'll later, we'll study the properties of this. But so feedback becomes a third decomposition technique that we need to be able to handle real system, to handle complicated signal flow graphs. And now you can take most any signal flow graph and decompose it into one overall transfer function by simply repeatedly applying the series connections, parallel connections, and the feedback connections. And we worked an example like that at the end of last class, but now you have a little more tools for that. So let's now apply this to a circuit. Here we have a simple RC circuit, and we're going to assume that the 1 ohm resistor and 2 farad capacitor, and our input X of T is going to be a DC source 7 plus a sine wave 3 sine of 5T, and that's going to start at time 0, and we're going to assume zero initial conditions. So, what the first thing we want to ask is, what is the form, if this is the input, what types of things are we going to see at the output when we start looking at the output on our scope at time equals zero?
Time equals zero, there's no initial conditions.
So the initial conditions are zero. So what's going to happen, let's start work our way back. What's going to happen at time infinity?
It'll be stable.
Okay, what are we going to see? What kind of an output are we going to see? We've got a sine wave as input and a DC source as input.
It won't be a perfect sine wave at a certain frequency.
Well, so we're certainly going to see a sine wave output at this frequency. It'll have a different amplitude and a different phase, because of the impedances. And then what about the DC value? We should see some kind of DC value in the output also, right? So we're going to see an offset sine wave. at time infinity. Now, if we back that up, what's going to happen between steady state and time zero?
Transient analysis.
Okay. Could you be more specific?
It's going to increase.
MATLAB,
going to be
transient analysis.
Possibly.
It's going to be a climbing sine.
Well, what's going to happen to the capacitor?
Charge.
This is a linear system, right? So one way to think about this is just do these each separately. So let's ignore the sine wave for a moment. What's going to happen with the DC value? It's going to charge the capacitor, right? So we should see some kind of
exponential increase.
It's going to have a sine wave kind of modulation on top of it, but then it'll eventually stabilize out to a sine wave. So we should see something like, we're going to have a final value that will be a sine wave. We should see something that has an envelope of an exponential. Maybe it looks something like this. Which, yes, MATLAB would be good to, at this point, to invoke. But we can actually work through some of this. So we have the Fourier, the Laplace transform of this input is just, we can invoke our tables. The Laplace transform of the DC value is easy, that's just 7 times 1 over S. The Laplace transform of a sine wave is actually omega over S squared plus omega squared. In this case, omega is equal to 5. So we can write that as 3 times 5 over S squared plus 5 squared plus 7 over S. We did the transfer function for this circuit last class. We have 1 over RC divided by S plus 1 over RC. And we can then multiply these two, H of S times Y of X of S, and sort of multiply that out and get this rather intimidating looking polynomial here. But if we look at this from a partial fractions point of view, we're going to have A over S plus B over S plus 1 half plus CS plus D over S squared plus 5 squared. So there's going to be 3 components to the output. What does the inverse Laplace transform of this thing look like? That's just going to be a DC value step, right? So that's going to describe this offset. What about this term?
It's just a line, so it's going to be...
What's the inverse Laplace transform of this?
It's
an exponential, right?
Yeah, it's e to the negative 1 half t.
Right. And then what is this thing going to look like?
That's going to be, 2 times e to the negative 2t?
What's that going to look like? That's the sine wave piece. Different amplitude, different phase, but it's basically the sine wave piece. So the output will have these 3 components to it: the DC value, the exponential charge, and the sine wave. Now the detail, the details are, in fact, if you can read ahead. So last time I think I gave this as a problem for the students in MATLAB. And it didn't go over too well. But this is something that you can easily solve in MATLAB. So if somebody wants to take a crack at that, I'll be willing to give you some extra credit.
This isn't decaying exponential. Can it be a rising exponential?
Well, it's rising in the, right. I mean, it's rising in the sense, but it's
decaying positive.
Okay.
You've got this either minus A to it's stable. It can't be growing. The exponential part can't be growing. What's actually happening is the exponential is decaying and leaving just the DC value. So what you're going to see is something like 1 minus E to the minus A T. That's what the combination of these two essentially give you. So that as this goes to 0, then you're just left with the 1. So this is a good example of a problem where I would say, well, you should be able to lay it out with Laplace transforms, but you can leave the details to MATLAB. But you should be able to do a sanity check on your output manually. And I think when you get to that level of comfort with these things, then you know, then you're in pretty good shape in terms of understanding this material. So, what I want to do for the rest of the time is to just talk a little bit about, basically just review like we did last time. So the exam will cover everything through today's lecture. And let's just go through the topics that we covered since the last exam and try to hit the high points of those topics. So the two lectures before last exam that technically weren't covered on the exam were the modulation, demodulation. What were the main things we learned about, learned in these two lectures? The kind of high level basic concepts. So we learned about how radios work, right?
Yeah.
And what were the relevant aspects of that from using concepts in this course? We make use of, for example, particular theorems.
How you can recover your original signal from.
We talked about AM modulation.
Yeah.
And what was the transform did we talk about and did we use to derive the properties of that?
Fourier.
And what property of the Fourier transform?
Is it the linear?
So how do we how do we modulate a signal to do AM modulation? We multiply it by a sine wave, right? And we said that does what to the frequency domain?
Shifts it.
It shifts it up and down in frequency, right? And so that allows us then to essentially modulate and demodulate a signal. Demodulation, we just multiply by the sine wave again and we'll pass filter. So the main thing that we hit on here was the concept of modulation. And we talked a little bit about asynchronous demodulation as well, but the main thing there was the concept of modulation. And then we talked a little bit about the practical issues with Dolly radios and how commercial radios demodulate things down to a common intermediate frequency and things like that. So I won't really spend much time, I won't ask you anything about this on the exam. So then in this section of the course, we began with the discrete-time Fourier transform. So what is the discrete-time Fourier transform? And what is it analogous to for continuous-time signals?
It's basically a Fourier transform done with summations instead of integrals.
Right, so it's what we use for discrete-time signals. It's the analogy of the continuous-time Fourier transform. So we call this the DTFT, and it's analogous to the CTFT. And I mention that because we need to understand that what this is relative to this. Mm-hmm. So, but with the discrete-time Fourier transform, this gave us a way of getting the frequency response of a discrete-time signal. And we wrote that as a sum from minus infinity to plus infinity of the signal times this complex exponential term. And we talked about its properties. It obeys all the usual things, linearity, superposition, all those kinds of properties. And we talked a little bit about, we demonstrated application to some common signals like pulses and things. Now, what was wrong with the discrete-time Fourier transform from a practical point of view?
It wasn't bound.
It goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, and that is not really good if you're dealing with something like a computer, like MATLAB. So we introduced the discrete Fourier transform. What's the principal difference between these two?
There's the sample size.
So how did we get to the discrete Fourier transform from the discrete time Fourier transform?
Due to a boundary.
We took the sum over a finite number of terms, right? We took the sum from n equals 0 to n minus 1 instead of from minus infinity to plus infinity. We also sampled the frequency domain. We took samples at equispaced points along the frequency domain instead of having a continuous function of frequency. So this allowed us to take a discrete time signal, a vector of points, and produce a vector of points that represents samples of the frequency domain, samples of the frequency response of that signal. Now, how did we relate these two? Under what conditions, how do you compare these two? So, for example, if I have a signal, if I have some signal, and this is x of t, and let's assume for the moment that the magnitude of its frequency response looks something like this. If I take the discrete time Fourier transform of this signal, what kind of a spectrum do I get?
You get two poles.
You get mirrors of that one.
What?
You get mirrors of that
one. Very good. And where will they be centered at? Very good, the sample frequency. Very, very good. Because this is something that we didn't talk about until we got to the sampling theorem. So this is the Fourier, the continuous time Fourier transform. This is the discrete time Fourier transform. And if we sample the signal properly, we later talked about the sampling theorem. If we sample the signal properly, then there won't be aliasing and everything will look proper. Now, what if I take the discrete time, the discrete Fourier transform? So I take now a window of this signal and I compute the frequency response of that portion of the signal.
It's only one period of the waveform, so wouldn't that be legitimate to do?
Yes, it would be legitimate to do. It just has to be, it needs a proper interpretation.
You get the resonant frequencies of that waveform. Or like the component frequencies?
Close. Okay. We said that the DFT is a sampling of the DTFT. So what I will get, if I've done this right, is samples of the spectrum spaced at what frequencies? This distance will be fs over n. Because what we did with the discrete Fourier transform was we essentially sampled this interval from 0 to 2 pi at n equispaced points. Now, the only complication is that the spectrum that we get is not the spectrum of the true signal, but the spectrum of the windowed version of this signal. The windowing, the truncation, introduces some distortion. Because like you were pointing out, if this window is too small, we may not even have one period of the signal in there. But assuming this window is sufficiently large and we get enough of the signal in there, the two spectra will be very close.
So what is the bearing of the fs over n, like in the spacing and the response? I don't see what's happening.
So to make this a little more concrete, let's assume this is our favorite piece of music, sampled at 44.1 kilohertz. And I ask you to give me a spectrum of that signal in MATLAB. So you go into MATLAB and you set n equals to 100. How these are spaced then at how far apart? 44.1 kilohertz. Over 100, which is 4,000 hertz. or about 400 hertz. That's not really very good, right? If you looked at that on your, if you in fact did this in real time using one of these audio display tools, the spectrum that you would see would not look very good. It wouldn't look a whole lot like music. What you would have to do, in fact, is to set this up to at least 1024 to make it look reasonably good. That would give you 40 hertz resolution, which is still not great for music, but it's, you know, reasonable.
If you choose a larger value of n, does that increase the time over which you take samples?
Yes.
Okay.
And we talked about that too. So now, what's the downside if you take n really large, like 8,000?
You just made a low pass filter, right?
Exactly. Now you're since the signal, like music, is non-stationary, the music is changing within that 1 second, within that 8,000 sample window, and you're kind of smearing the signal. So we talked at the end of this. We talked about a spectrogram actually, which was sort of a time frequency display. We commented that for non-stationary signals, there's no right or wrong answer for how big n should be. It's a little knob you have to play with depending on what kind of information you're interested in.
Well, how do you get more samples in less time? I mean, is that a parameter that we have here?
Well, that's an interesting information theory question. Because remember also that the signal is band limited. So let's say instead of sampling, let's assume this signal has a bandwidth of 10 hertz. If I sample this signal at 100 hertz, I'm going to get, you know, 10 samples per period or something like that, right? If I sample this signal at 100,000 hertz, I'm going to get a lot more samples, right?
What are you going to get more?
But what am I really getting when I do this? All that I'm really doing is pushing out the spectrum and then uniformly sampling it. So I'm not really getting much additional information because most of those samples are being devoted to areas of the spectrum where there's really no energy. So the point here is that there's only so much information in this signal, and you can't really get more information beyond once you sample it at the frequency associated with the sampling theorem. That's about all the information that's really there. People will often try to sample the signal at a higher frequency, thinking they're getting more information, but they're just getting additional data points that they don't need. There's no new information in those data points. One way to think about this is once you know something's a sine wave, you don't need a lot of samples of that sine wave. You just need to know the frequency and the phase and the amplitude. The more you sample a sine wave, you don't really get new information. It may look prettier, but you don't really get new information. So with non-stationary signals like music, you can't upsample them to really high frequencies and get that much more information. The signal is time varying. It's just not, and when you want to compute the spectrum, you can only take so many samples before the signal starts changing within the window that you're using.
So there's like an ideal sample rate, not one too high, not one too low.
Right, and there's something actually called the time bandwidth product of the signal, which we don't talk about in this class, but in more advanced signal processing courses, you'll talk about this. And this is essentially a measure of how much true information is in the signal.
I'll let you know.
Since n can be chosen so arbitrarily,
so what?
Since n can be chosen so arbitrarily, mm-hmm. You think there could be a bonus on the test to choose an n for, you know, this?
I will tell you that there could be a severe penalty on the test if you choose the wrong n. Yeah, so you know, there's good ends and there's bad ends.
Good ones and bad ones.
Good ones and bad ones.
But, you know, and we showed actually a plot of a speed signal, and I showed you different versions of the spectrogram, just different values of n.
Right.
And there's no right or wrong version. Each of those told you different things about the signal. Okay, so then we talked about the fast Fourier transform. What was the main 2 points? Give me 2 significant points about the fast Fourier transform relative to the discrete Fourier transform.
You can do it
fast.
Okay,
and how did we achieve that fastness? Well, you can do it fast and what? Because, yes, on the exam there's a lot of things I can do quickly, but they may not give me the right answer, right?
Fast and accurate.
It's fast and accurate. You do it fast and get the same answer as the DFT. Under what constraints?
Assuming the signal is bounded?
No. This is an N. This is a question about N. What we had to make an assumption about N to get all the butterfly diagrams and all that to work out.
That's a good
N. That's a good N. And what was a good N for fast Fourier transform?
It's not that it's a power of 2.
Yes, it is that it's a power of 2. So we add the additional constraint that N, the order must be a power of 2, and then we can do the fast Fourier transform and get the same result as the discrete Fourier transform. Then we moved on to Fourier analysis of continuous time systems, and we showed that you could in fact compute the inputs and outputs and do frequency response and all those kinds of things for circuits and such using the Fourier transform for continuous time systems. And we talked a little bit about filters. Why can't you buy an ideal low-pass filter at Radio Shack?
Because they sell them more.
Because what?
Walmart has proprietary rights.
The sharp edges.
Yeah, it can't make it.
The ideal low pass filter has this very sharp transition. And what does that do to the impulse response of the filter?
It's infinitely low.
And it makes it non causal. So we talk about ideal filters. We talk about the fact that they're non causal, which means they can't really be implemented in real circuits, but we can approximate them. Interestingly enough, with discrete time systems, because you can buffer up data, you can actually implement non-causal systems if you're willing to tolerate delay. And that's why with most of the digital systems you look at, like we were talking at one time about how the audio gets out of sync with the video on the satellite and that kind of thing, that's because those systems buffer data so they can do kind of non-causal type operations. Then we talk about the sampling theorem, which I think we discussed over here. Reasons why, what is the Nyquist sample frequency? It's twice the bandwidth of the signal. How we can reconstruct the signal using either sine x over x interpolation or using low-pass filtering. We also talk about aliasing, what happens if a signal is undersampled. And that kind of thing. Then we talked about the Fourier transform of discrete time systems and showed that we could essentially do the same thing we could do with continuous time systems and get the exact same results. And then we talked a little bit about digital filter design with discrete time systems. We talked about an averaging filter as an example of that. Then we moved to the Laplace transform. And we talked about the bilateral or two-sided Laplace transform. We talked about the regions of convergence. Under what conditions does the Laplace transform converge? And a little bit about properties of rational systems that have rational transforms, meaning the transform is a ratio of two polynomials. We verified that the Laplace transform obeys many of the same properties that the Fourier transform did, linearity, superposition, and such. We talked about the initial and final value theorems And then we introduced the unilateral Laplace transform, the one-sided Laplace transform, which we tend to use for analyzing circuits because it gives us both the transient response and the steady state response simultaneously under the constraint that the signal is right side. The signal starts at t is equal to zero. We then introduced the inverse Laplace transform and said that it was really not a good idea to try to do the contour integration on the exam if you have to do an inverse Laplace transform. So we talked about practical ways of doing this using partial fractions, expansions, and such. And we talked about how to handle transforms that are ratios of two polynomials and transforms that might have exponential terms. The exponential terms are dealt with using the time delay theorems. Then we moved to differential equations, and we showed how with the Laplace transform we can essentially solve differential equations using simple algebra. Once you transform the equation into the Laplace domain, we discussed how to do that using our differentiation theorems, and then we were able to take a differential equation and transform it into a Laplace domain, solve for the transfer function and various things, and then take the inverse Laplace transform and get back to the time domain. And then we said that that was why we could do things like solve circuits problems, because circuits are ultimately just differential equations. So the circuit analysis that you're used to doing with Laplace transforms is essentially an application of that. And then the last thing we talked about over the last two classes was this notion of a signal flow graph and how we can decompose those using parallel series and feedback connections, and then how we can get the overall transfer function of the system using combinations of these operations. So that's everything that will be covered on the second exam. Next week we'll talk a little bit about Z transforms, but you won't be paying too much attention because you'll be worried about that. So the ground rules for the exam are the same. I will pick some subset of the homework problems as given in the exact replicas. So if you know how to do all the homework problems, you shouldn't have a problem. So questions, yes?
Can we print off the Laplace tables? Other than having it on our sheet?
Yeah. And I'll again have those available on the screen as well. And if there's ever an equation like that that you don't have for some reason, just ask me during the exam and I'll write it on the board. So the good news is, two-thirds of the course is done. So what was the major theme? What did we really learn about in the second part of this course?
Useful to move signals out of the time domain into various other domains to manipulate.
We learned how to manipulate signals in the frequency domain. That's a good point. What else?
Sine wave modulation.
We learned now the connection, the formal connection between analog and digital signals, and how we can use them interchangeably.
And you can represent other systems as simple circuits.
And then we learned about sort of block diagram analysis, that we can view all linear systems more or less as block diagrams. So the process of converting the physical system to a differential equation, that's one step, and that's usually done by the domain expert or by the physicist or whoever, the electrical engineer who works at that level of the problem. But once it becomes a differential equation, from there out, it becomes essentially a signal processing problem. And yes, we use abstract math to deal with that, but the point is not the abstract math, the point is the engineering that we can do on the system. So what we'll learn in the last third of the course is essentially how to do all this with discrete time signals. We'll learn about the Z transform, and then we'll actually apply this stuff. We'll learn about control systems and some other things like that. how we can actually make use of this theory to do useful things in the real world, like control and stabilize systems. Okay, I think that's it.